Hello and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week we bring you stories on all things chemical, from carbon black to kids. In this week's show, we're talking about motherhood. We'll learn about pregnancy tests and the first family of radioactivity. And we'll talk to an expert on fetal alcohol syndrome. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. The United States is in the midst of a baby boomlet. In 2006, the fertility rate reached 2.1, the highest it's been since 1971. The U.S. now has a higher fertility rate than most industrialized nations, including Canada, Australia, Japan, and every country in Europe. That means there are a lot of pregnant women in the U.S. right now. On today's show, we're taking a closer look at the chemistry of motherhood. Where better to start than the mother of modern chemistry and her daughters? Jennifer Dionisio has more in today's Element of the Week.
Poor Eve Curie, daughter of Marie and Pierre Curie, sister of Irene Curie, wife of Henry Richardson Labouisse Jr., Eve was the only member of this accomplished family to not receive a Nobel Prize. Her mother and father shared the 1903 prize in physics with Henri Becquerel. Within a few years, her mother was also awarded the Nobel for chemistry. Her sister Irene shared the 1935 prize in chemistry with her husband, Frédéric Joliot, and Eve's own husband accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 1965 on behalf of UNICEF. Then there's the radioactive element curium, first synthesized at Berkeley by Glenn Seaborg, Ralph James, and Albert Ghiorso in 1944. That team named their discovery after Eve's parents in recognition of their path-breaking work on radioactivity. Marie Curie's accomplishments as the first woman to receive a Nobel Prize and one of only two people to receive Nobels in two different fields are well known. But she was also the mother of two accomplished daughters, Irene and Eve. Irene also worked on radioactivity. She won the Nobel for her work on the action of neutrons on the heavy elements, an important step in the discovery of uranium fission. And while Eve never won a Nobel, she made a name for herself as a writer. She published nonfiction, wrote for theater and film, and worked as a foreign correspondent during World War II. Curium, the element named for Eve's parents, Marie and Pierre, doesn't occur naturally, but it is present in the environment in small amounts as the result of atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. It has few uses, mostly for scientific research. Its short half-life and lack of utility make it an odd tribute to Marie Curie, who made important and enduring accomplishments, both as a scientist and a mother. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at CHF's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. Modern pregnancy pushes women into a thicket of conflicting medical opinion, not to mention social norms. As anyone who's ever been chastised for ordering a coffee while visibly pregnant can tell you, attitudes and advice about food and drink are particularly charged. To find out more about how ideas about alcohol and pregnancy have changed over the years, CHF's Audra Wolf spoke to Janet Golden, author of Message in a Bottle, The Making of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the idea of fetal alcohol syndrome came about?
There was a physician in Seattle who was being called to a delivery. She was a pediatrician, and the obstetrician said to her, "And what do you know about alcohol-exposed babies?" And she knew nothing, but she delivered a baby that was clearly had some alcohol in its breath at delivery. And she then alerted another physician who is an expert in what we call dysmorphology, the science of deformities and their cause. And they began to look around at the records of infants who'd been born to severely alcoholic women and saw that they all had the same characteristics. They had a syndrome. They had a particular looking face. They were very short stature, and they were all mentally retarded. And that got us thinking, what does alcohol exposure do in utero?
Now, at one point, alcohol was actually recommended at certain points in pregnancy. That seems like a fairly foreign concept to a lot of us now. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll go back further than that. After Prohibition ended, Americans had to be taught how to drink. And the alcoholic beverage industry did a very good job, and people began to say, it's great to go home and have a drink before dinner. And this was translated by some obstetricians, especially when they had very worried patients, to, gee, you're so nervous about your pregnancy or you're not getting a good night's sleep, why don't you have a drink? That was phase one. Phase two came when they began to use alcohol to prevent premature deliveries, premature labor. So sometimes women in early labor would go to the hospital and be given intravenous infusions of alcohol, or if it was a very nice hospital, they might get some orange juice with vodka. Turns out alcohol doesn't actually have any effect in halting those contractions, and we've now moved on to magnesium sulfate and some other effective substances. So it was a big shock for physicians to suddenly be told, you know what, don't tell your patients to have a drink before dinner or to have a drink before they go to sleep. Tell your patients not to drink alcohol, because some pediatricians and some scientists have come up with some new data about the effects of abusive drinking.
Pregnant women receive so many conflicting messages about what they should do, what they should eat, what they should drink. But given the conflicting messages that they're getting, what do we really know about intrauterine chemistry?
Very little, because, of course, we can't really do the kinds of experiments that would give us the answers we wanted. Maybe light drinking is good for us. We're not going to be able to do that experiment because we know that heavy drinking, or that any fetus could be very susceptible, is a problem. So that experiment is off the table. Is this substance dangerous? Well, it depends which test animal we use. So very hard to get good science on intrauterine chemistry. As for public health advice, that's something different. We go with what we know to be teratogenic, and that would be tobacco has a warning, alcohol has a warning. I believe we have warnings about how much fish to consume because we know mercury is a teratogen. And all the rest of it is guesswork.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Audra.
Janet Golden is a professor of history at Rutgers University, Camden. Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. If basic demographics are anything to go by, odds are that about half the listeners of this podcast will at some point in their lives find themselves in a bathroom with a pregnancy testing kit. Today's kits are accurate, easy to use, and yield results in minutes. But it hasn't always been so easy. Erin McCleary has more in this week's Chemistry in Your Cupboard.
When home pregnancy tests first came on the market about 30 years ago, they were a far cry from today's simple sticks. Women had to wait until their period was 9 days late before testing, and then carry out a precise set of steps, placing 3 drops of urine into a test tube, adding some chemicals, and then letting the tube sit undisturbed for 2 hours. The slightest speck of dirt or detergent, the tiniest vibration from a fridge or air conditioner, even direct sunlight, could all spoil the test. Once the reaction was complete, women had to then use a mirror to see whether a dark brown, donut-shaped ring had formed at the bottom of the tube, indicating pregnancy. But these finicky tests were an improvement over older laboratory-based methods of pregnancy testing. Researchers had first hit upon checking for pregnancy hormones in the urine in the 1920s. Back then, they needed 35 days after a missed period to diagnose pregnancy, but the test was 98% accurate, a big advance over other methods of the time. But these early urine tests took 4 days and required the sacrifice of 5 mice. Later, less lethal versions of the test relied first on rabbits, then on South African frogs. When these female frogs are injected with a pregnant woman's urine, they lay a large number of eggs within less than a day. These results were fast and easy, and tests using frogs and toads became the standard. By the 1960s, researchers had a better understanding of human chorionic gonadotropin, the hormone that makes urine-based pregnancy tests work, and developed an immunological test using antibodies. The antibody-based test took just a few hours to work and didn't use animals at all. Instead, its components could be easily freeze-dried and packaged for use in hospitals and doctors' offices. Over time, these tests became more and more sensitive, meaning they could be used sooner after a missed period and yielded faster results. They became so easy to use, in fact, that the FDA approved home versions of the tests in 1977. And by the mid-1980s, the now familiar stick test was introduced, making pregnancy testing at home practically foolproof. You might, however, wonder about what happened to all those frogs. Pregnancy tests are what brought the South African clawed frog Xenopus laevi to the United States. Although they lost their day job in the 1960s, they became popular aquarium pets. But many of their owners, dismayed by the frogs' huge appetites and fondness for killing fish, released them into the wild. And by the late 1960s, they had infiltrated many wild areas. As the New York Times reported in 1977, the frogs could live anywhere, eat anything, and survive under the most adverse conditions. With no natural predators, they multiplied rapidly. A fitting payback, perhaps, to the humans who brought them here because of sex. For Distillations, I'm Erin McCleary.
Erin McCleary is curator of exhibits at CHF. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from the British journalist Catherine Whitehorn. In our society, mothers take the place elsewhere occupied by the fates, the system, Negroes, communism, or reactionary imperialist plots. Mothers go on getting blamed until they're 80, but shouldn't take it personally. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer, with help this week from Lissa Rome. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indivero, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.